Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello and welcome to Following On. I'm John Norman, today bringing you an exclusive interview with one of the greats of English cricket, Marcus Trescothick, who sits down with Neil Manthorpe to discuss his illustrious career.
As easy as you like, just helped on its way by Marcus Trescothick.
Over the course of the programme, we'll discuss his astonishing spell at the very top of the game, that 2005 Ashes series.
England have regained the Ashes at the Oval.
And the impact he's had on the game by speaking out about mental health. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2, and without further ado, it's time to hear from Marcus Trescothick in conversation with Neil Manthorpe.
He's one of England's greatest cricketers, and I mean the country rather than the team, and also one of its most enduring, having played an astonishing 27 seasons for Somerset in England, scoring over 26,000 first-class runs, almost 6,000 for England, before retiring from international cricket, aged just 31.
It'll race away. Nicely played by Trescothick in four runs.
And it's for speaking out about mental health and working with players to help them cope with the vagaries of the game that he will be remembered, as well as for his staggering career, during which he played 852 games across the formats.
Three lovely strokes by Trescothick.
And scored 122 centuries.
There it is. The first time Marcus Trescothick has scored 100 against Australia.
Marcus Trescothick, welcome to the Cricket Collective here on TalkSport 2. Those numbers make my eyes water.
Well, when you say 27 years, it felt like 27 years. My knees and back and everything else are thanking me a little bit more now, I would say, for giving them a bit of a time off. But still great fun. Loved it. I would have carried on playing if I was still good enough to do so, or if it didn't hurt quite as bad. But I just have that sort of passion and love of the game, of wanting to just keep going on and doing what we do.
Have those numbers sunk in, though? I mean, I was going to ask you, what's it like being an ex-cricketer now? But you've been a cricketer for 27 years. Yeah. Were you aware of that, of just what a mountain you were building?
Look, I guess, you know, having go through various sort of pre-seasons and then press days and things, everybody reminds you every day and every year when you go in that sort of time. But, you know, you're gradually accumulating the runs that you do and you're achieving milestones and passing certain records for people. And that's, you know, it's part of playing for a long period of time, and comes at the back end of people's careers when you have done. But it was great, you know. I would have carried on and loved to have continued doing that, and continued building up the volume of what it was, because it was just a huge passion of what you do.
High in the air, that's going to go all the way. Very big hit there from Trescothick.
You said gradually accumulating. There were times when it was anything but gradual. Particularly in the one-day game, I mean, you scored runs very, very quickly at times, and you went through patches of deep purple, didn't you, where the runs just flowed.
Yeah, and they're the moments in your career that you really sort of sit back and enjoy, because You're searching or striving for that sort of form all the time. You're wanting the consistency and the level of performance that, you know, that you really sort of feel, you know, at those moments in time, you want them to last forever. But you, I think we all know that that's not going to be the case, but you try and stretch them out and make the most of them when they're there, because they're a superb place to be. You enjoy the game so much more when it just feels so simple and so easy when it comes to that sort of the time when you get.
When you retired from international cricket, you said, I don't know whether it was tongue-in-cheek or semi-serious, you said, I'm going to have to keep working for as long as possible to make up for the loss of your England salary. You yeah. couldn't have thought you'd play another 12 years.
No. I thought probably I was looking at sort of maybe, you know, late 30s, and you get into 40. To go to 43 was a joy, really, an absolute honour to, you know, to think that you could sort of stretch it out and be good enough to sort of play within that time. But the game looked after me brilliantly. You know, I think it wasn't about, you know, earning the money and playing for that long period of time. It was the passion and the love of going out there and scoring runs and winning games with the team.
There's one innings that I'd really like to ask you about. But before that, which are the three or four which come instantly to your mind?
Well, I regard my best innings for England was the 180 at Johannesburg.
Trescothick moves on to his 10th 100. Magnificent innings from Marcus Trescothick.
Just at the right time, I was sort of peaking or getting close to my peak of playing at my best. And, you know, as a team, we were growing rapidly to becoming very good. And it was at the right time. Everything sort of fell into place. We were losing all the wickets all around. And suddenly I felt the form that I needed to get. And I managed to get a big score and sort of dominate the innings to get the team into a position. And then we went on to bowl them out in the afternoon, which was absolutely superb from, you know, to sit back and enjoy that, knowing that you'd made a big impact. You know, that whole tour in general, I felt I played at my best, and see that as the best part of my England career. So that would be one. There was a 200, my highest score, I would say, in both Test cricket and for Somerset. So I got 219 at the Oval. Was probably when my concentration level was at its best.
It's full, it's through, and it's four, and it's 200 to Marcus Trescothick.
You know, when you have those days where you're pretty much invincible and you can do what you want to do, and you think, right, where shall I want to hit this, or where am I going to sort of control this game, and how are you going to go about it? I always just sort of describe it as sort of being in the Matrix, the film The Matrix, when they're being shot at and bullets are flying and you're just sort of ducking and weaving and so much, like slow motion.
Oh, I'm seeing it big. I fancy you, Mr. Hall. And up comes 150 to Marcus Trescothick.
I remember there was periods within the innings where I could see the ball coming down and the seam coming down, and it's almost like you could count the stitches, because you were so clear in what you're thinking and what you were watching. It just made it absolutely perfect, and you just wish that every day could be in that sort of way, because it must be an amazing game for those people who see it like that, a Kohli, a Smith, and they seem to have those days a lot more than everybody else. And then I got 200, my high score, 284 at Northampton. Again, you know, to get close to going up to a 300 and to bat for a long period of time. Again, it was built around concentration of that for me. When I got my concentration levels really good and really spot on, I found that I could go for a long period of time and not really changing the tempo or changing the way that my brain was operating. It was just machine-like going through the process to get those big scores. And you just, you know, you're grasping on for those moments and wish you could have had them more, because they were delightful times to be playing the game.
That was the innings that I wanted to talk about. The 219 at the Oval. I mean, people forget the context often when they look at a score. I mean, the point about that is that South Africa were 2-1 up in the series, and it had been a monumental series, of course. And then they're 350 for two, batting first. England staged a brilliant fight back, but nonetheless, South Africa still made 484. You know, yeah. a dozen short of 500. England need to square the series. They need something really, really special. You don't win too many test matches having conceded 484.
No, you don't. No.
And then, so you go out there, smash 219, and England makes 600. And, of course, win on the fifth day. It was an incredible comeback.
Yeah. I think we then bowled South Africa out for, what, about 150 or 180, I think it was?
Yeah.
And we had, like, 70 or 80, I think, to knock off for the final wicket. But a brilliant test match, nonetheless. Alex Stewart's final test match. So you're almost thinking, you know, you're wanting a special moment for a special career for somebody like that. But you're right. When the first team or the opposition score 480 in the first innings, you very rarely go on to win a game. You'll save many games when that happens if it's a good pitch, but quite often you'll find yourself on the back end of it. But it's one of those days one of those games that sort of really clicked for me, and we got those big scores. But good pitch. The Oval was a brilliant ground and a brilliant pitch for me to bat on. If I could choose anywhere in the world to bat, it would be the Oval. It just always felt good and a nice place to be.
High in the air. That's going to go all the way. Very big hit there from Trescothick.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on Talk Sport 2, and an exclusive interview with the former Somerset and England batsman, Marcus Trescothick. A key moment in his international career came in February 2006. He left England's tour of India suffering with mental health issues. And here he speaks to Neil Manthorpe about his battle with that and how he's learnt to understand it better. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
I could talk about your career for the whole programme, but I mentioned in the introduction what you will also be remembered for. Your legacy will be as much off the field as on it, obviously. The honesty with which you handled your illness and the subsequent campaigning for mental health awareness, that people will all, I mean, non-cricketing people know you for that. Are you comfortable with that?
Yes, I am, yeah. I've sort of, the journey that I've taken with all the mental health stuff has really given me something to get stuck into. I'm quite proud of the fact of the way that myself and, you know, writing the book and telling people all about it has been given the whole illness and mental health issues in general a bit of something, a bit of backbone and a bit of understanding to people to let them know. And I'm proud of the fact that I've been able to talk about it in the way that I have done. And it's really helped me, because it's helped destigmatize it and normalize it in many different ways that, helps it for me, to make it okay. I'm very open in telling people now, even at the, whenever I'm working or whatever I'm doing, is that I'm feeling rough. I'm not feeling great. It's just, I need to go and see my counsellor or whatever it would be to be able to, to get the help that, I need to do. And that makes it so much easier for me rather than having to hide away. And that was very much part of the situation. When I first came back with India, then from Australia, I was having to hide away and not tell people what was really happening or not was really going on. And that was hard, because I was constantly worried that people were going to find out. So the best way I could see out of it was to just go and say, right, look, here it is. You want to know everything? Here it is. I'll lay it on the table for you. The reaction for that, I didn't know what was going to happen, of course. I couldn't quite understand before people read about it what their reaction was going to be. But I didn't quite probably expect it was going to be as good as what it was.
You mentioned the book, your biography, Coming Back to Me, which I've read in the last week. I've been meaning to read it ever since you wrote it in 2007, but I finally got around to it. And the phrase that made such a big impact on me was that anxiety was an illness, not a weakness. And that's a phrase that has liberated hundreds of cricketers, and not just cricketers, but specifically cricketers. You said destigmatized. It seems staggering now that it was such a stigma. Throughout most of my career, cricketers have been just absolutely unable to admit to any mental health issues. I mean, you've changed the cricket world.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. It's like everybody has mental health you know, and it's good mental health. Same as you have physical health, it's exactly the same. And when you pull a hamstring or you break a finger, your physical health is not right. It's not working. So it's exactly the same with your brain. You know, when your mental health is not working in the same way, you're needing some way to operate and to restructure it. And now that may be medication, that may be counseling, that may be mindfulness, whatever it may be. But, you know, we all have a certain degree of good mental health. And when it goes bad for people, and it does go bad for people more than others, it's a lot easier to correct. But you know, I think in the past, it's been the stigma around it has been, okay, mental health problems means you're nuts and you need to be stuck in an institute for a period of time. You know, the word about mental breakdown, that really gets me. It's just like a nervous breakdown from people. It's like, it's not, it's just a period of health in your mind where it's not operating in the same fashion. It's still the word when you get the breakdown word comes around, that still means to me that there's still people seeing it in a different fashion than potentially what it is. It's just ill health in the mind and in different ways. So, you know, we're on a journey, and I think we have changed it over time, and people have understood it and started to realize with the fact that everybody suffers with it in some form of way, or a lot of people will, that we've come to understand that there's more of a meaning to it when it's not right.
Do you think administrators could do more, Trez? Do you think that players ought to be able to say, I'm not up for this tour, or I need a break from the game? It is happening more and more. Look in Australia. I mean, that's changed phenomenally there. People are taking little sabbaticals and just say, look, I just can't do another tour. Yeah. Do you think administrators could catch up a little bit with their empathy?
Well, I think they are. I think they are looking at it very much so now. You know, the wellness side of the game is definitely looked upon by the sports sciences. You know, the medical people trying to get that in place to look after their well-being before, you know, anything happened, you know, before it gets too bad. But I think as a group, as a management group, as administrators, I think you've got to be open to the idea, because there are going to be periods in people's careers when they're going to need to, if they struggle with ill health, then they're going to need to be at potentially just sort of have a little break. And that could be week, 2 weeks, 4 months, you know, whatever it's going to be. And we have seen more recent cases in Australia where they've put their hands up and said, I need a little rest from the game just to try and get my mental health back on track and come back and do that. And they, Cricket Australia, have been great with dealing with that. And that's a credit to them. You know, we've been, because of the situations we've had with various people dealing with it in England, I believe the ECB, the PCA, the counties, England Cricket are ahead of the game because of the situation we've had to deal with. We were very much behind it with my situation. No one knew what to do and how to deal with it. But it's now very much at the forefront of, you know, of English cricket about how to try and help.
When you started the book, did you always intend to be so brutally honest, or did you sort of get into it and think, oh, sod it, I'm gonna give it everything here?
No, I think it needed to be. I needed to tell my story as the real story. Many periods over the course of me coming back from India initially, and then Australia, there was so much written. You know, with social media nowadays, and the media in general were after it, after the real story about what was going on, and they were looking in the wrong place. You know, they were causing troubles which made it really hard for me and made my mental health problems even worse. So I needed to say, look, this is the story. Here you go. This is it. This is how it was. And the only way I was going to do that really was to be and to tell it as it happened. And, you know, as the real problems occurred while away, while at home and dealing with it all that way. And that was the best thing for me.
In the book, when you're describing how you felt, you mentioned irrational fears, despair, panic. You said that you thought you were going to die when you had the first breakdown in Baroda. Yeah. But, you know, as a father of two children, and you were a young father of one child there, there must have been just simple guilt that all cricketers feel when they're away from home for a long time. You know, your wife Hayley was at home by herself with Ellie. She was very young. I mean, the term anxiety doesn't really do that justice. I mean, it's terribly hard.
Yeah, very tough. And, you know, a lot of young sportsmen go through that whole feeling now when they have to leave their families behind for a certain period of time. Yes, the families do travel to most tours for a certain period. But I think it was just the massive overwhelming of being the anxiety and the feeling what it was just feeding itself by being away. It started with one thing to the second thing, and suddenly you're putting all these things together. And then it was just a colossal amount of worry and problems and not sleeping, not eating, not drinking, trying to focus on cricket and then being unhappy and being upset. You know, can you imagine putting all this together over a couple of weeks? It just grew into a huge storm that needed a good period of time away to really understand and sort of reassess where I was going and what I was doing and how I was going to cope with it, because I didn't know. First of all, I didn't have a clue to what extent I was ill or needed help with. And until you get to that point where you do and you understand it, it's very tricky to sort of turn it around. You know, I'm better at doing it now because I have an understanding of it. But it's very tricky at that moment in time. I remember saying to the doctor, when I came back from India and we disappeared out of the way of the media for a couple of days.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I remember the doctor had to come in because I felt so rough and I was so upset and I couldn't sit still. And I said, "Doc, there's something wrong with me. Just take me to hospital. There's something really wrong, and I just don't know what it is." You know, and that's the power of the mind. You know, it can control the body, it can control your thoughts and everything that goes with it, and make you feel absolutely awful. You know, he then described the symptoms or actually what it was, and obviously it makes perfect sense. But it still took a long period of time to get used to it.
Are you grateful to the way Duncan Fletcher handled the situation?
I have no problems with what, you know, he said initially at the time, because it was personal reasons, I think, were stated. I was in no frame of mind to worry about what was being said from that point of view. Yes, it may have fueled a little bit, of course, but it soon sort of got put to bed afterwards, you know, after, you know, getting through the journey a little bit more and letting people know about it. But because of the lack of awareness, I think, because no one had really been in that situation and been able to explain it, that was the sort of go-to thing. We can see now, as we talk about going back to Cricket Australia, straight away they're saying, yep, that he needs a little bit of time to reassess their mental health and get that back on track. It puts it to bed straight away. You know, if we'd have had the experience of what we have now, then things would have been easy enough to deal with.
Still to come on the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2, Marcus Trescothick talks about how his journey with his mental health has affected current professionals. You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with the Institute of Cricket.
There it is. The first time Marcus Trescothick has scored 100 against Australia in both One Day Internationals and Test Match cricket. It's a big moment for him.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 and our exclusive interview with the former Somerset and England batsman, Marcus Trescothick. Having discussed his own experiences with mental health, here he discusses whether cricket has a problem with the illness and whether anything can be done to help prevent players suffering from it.
The second time when your career came to an end, the 06-07, the beginning of the Ashes down under, again, you described the situation where you're struggling desperately with jet lag, which I really sympathise with. Yeah. You're on the sleeping tablets. You finally get to sleep in the early hours of the morning. Yeah. And then there's a knock on your hotel door at 7:30. Somebody wants you to pee in a cup for a drugs test. Yeah. Well, that'd be enough to most people to snap.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I was thinking at that time, crikey, I've taken a mountain of drugs here in the last sort of 36 hours just to get me here. So, you know, what if there's something in one of these drugs and I'm going to, you know, so all this was just worrying me, you know, just because I was in that anxious state anyway. Yeah. And obviously very typical about, you know, going to that part of the world, having A, we'd beaten them in 05. So they wanted revenge and beating us up. And they started it from day one, which was self-explanatory really. But yeah, jet lag does have an impact, I think, on your mental health, because obviously you get tired and you get sort of worn down a little bit. So, you know, trying to stay on top of that is always important. But that's part and parcel of when you go to these parts of the world. When you go on a tour in there, you've got to be used to this part of what's going to happen. Easier now as a coach, because no one's going to care about who you are. And, you know, you're there to do a different job. But it's a lot different, I would say.
How did you feel? Well, you probably didn't care at the time, because you had bigger things to be concerned about. But retrospectively, people who described you as suffering from homesickness, it's a little disparaging. And also, did it make you angry when people said that you were being unpatriotic and your country needed you and you're the best player? What are you doing going home?
I hadn't really seen much about it at that time, because I was avoiding social media, what was around at that sort of time, luckily. I'm sure it would have been a lot worse if it had been in this day and age. But yeah, I just avoided everything because I felt so bad. I didn't want to get wrapped up in what was being said here, there and everywhere, because any bit of negativity would at that point would have made me feel 10 times worse and just taken me off in a different direction, worrying about something else that really didn't need to worry about. But you know, you can't control that side of the media or the game or what goes on. It's just part and parcel of it. You've just got to try and take yourself away from it, and when they understand it a little bit more, then potentially they will, you know, be able to go, okay, hands up, it wasn't that case, it wasn't that way, we take it all back.
Tell us a bit about your work with the PCA now, and also, I mean, there barely a week goes by without somebody crediting you for helping them, either directly or indirectly. I mean, the most recent two I've seen are Liam Plunkett and Nick Compton. Have you had a lot of people thanking you personally?
Well, I would say I've had quite a numerous amount of behind-the-scenes conversations with people who maybe you just want to ask questions. You know, what were my symptoms? What did it feel like? How did I cope with it dealing with the club? You know, what was it like playing when you were feeling in that sort of fashion? Many different ways. And, you know, I've had some great conversations being out there batting with certain people saying, I feel awful today. And he goes, yeah, I feel awful as well. But, you know, that's the sort of ironic sort of side of it you can get to after a while, because you know, once you've got an understanding with people that you bat with, you can be open and honest and say, I feel terrible, I feel awful. And it's nice to, of course, it's really nice to, you know, to think that you made an impact and helped them potentially, you know, with a quick phone call here and there, or how you doing, or you know, trying to get them help with the PCA or with people and stuff like that. Really, you do your best to try and make them happy, because you appreciate how tough a place they're in. And how they must be feeling because of, you know, you experiencing it yourself.
Reading the book, I'm left with a very strong impression that there's nothing you could have done differently. Even if there had been, if we'd been 10 or 15 years further down the road, I mean, if you reached that Baroda moment in 2020, for example, I've just left with the impression that, you know, as you said, it just is what it is, and it was what it was. And, you know, it's like being born with a blood condition or something. You know, you can't change it. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. The only thing I would say to sort of counteract that is, because of the awareness now, and you look at, like we talked about already, about administrators allowing players a bit more time off. Yes, I missed a series in Zimbabwe and I got injured. I broke a thumb when I missed three games against India. I reckon I would have played a lot more potentially now in relation to what they do nowadays, where they'll build in a period of time where there might be a rest period for them and might be a looked at. Or I may have gone to them and said, oh, I'm not quite operating right. And we might have been able to do something to counteract it a little bit quicker and get on top of the process quicker. But I think it was just something that was in me. It wasn't something that was brought about because of playing cricket for a long period of time. And it's not something I could have done a great deal about it being there. But we might have been able to do something to help it with the awareness and with understanding the illness, what we do, probably more now than what we did sort of 20 years ago.
Cricket is a bit of a petri dish, isn't it, for poor mental health, given that bowlers and batsmen as individuals are destined to fail far, far more than they are to succeed, if we measure it in terms of reaching 50 or taking 5 wickets or scoring 100, that kind of thing. Also, the time away from home, the inherent unfairness of it, perhaps as well. Although golfers, many golfers I know tell me that golf's the most inherently unfair game. But cricket, it is a breeding ground, isn't it, for poor mental health?
Potentially. And I think there's a lot of cases of it, isn't there, where we see it from the past of people, I guess, taking their own lives more than anything else. Back, you know, going back over the years. I personally, I don't know whether it breeds poor mental health playing cricket. I've not seen any studies to say that it does or whatever it is. Yes, we appreciate it's very cutthroat in terms of success and failure is highlighted very easily. Where in comparison, if you're playing in a game in a team of 11 or 15, everybody's in it closer together. But batting and bowling is a very individual game in a team sport, which we know. So you get pinpointed as being you've had success or you've had failure a lot easier. But I think when we talk about 1 in 3, 1 in 4 people in the general population of England and in the world will suffer with mental health problems, I can't understand why cricket would be any more of a reason than anything else.
Well, time.
Just been highlighted.
Just the time, Trez. The time it takes to play and be away from home. And
But there's other... You know, there's other industries that have that sort of time. Yes, I appreciate we play 5-day games or 4-day games in first-class cricket. I can't see how it can be. I may be wrong, right? This is me sitting back and looking at it, and I've answered this question numerous times on different topics. And I want somebody to go, right, here's the data, here's the information to show me cricket is more susceptible to be having poor mental health in comparison to playing football or rugby or whatever it may be. And it might be, it might well be, but I'm yet to see it. I'm just trying to think in my own mind, why would it be any different when 1 in 3, 1 in 4 people in the general population will suffer at some point? You know, what makes it any different? I don't know.
And out of the ground comes the stumps. England have regained the Ashes at the Oval. September the 12th, 2005. The match here is drawn. Let the celebrations begin.
Let's have a little reminisce about the 2005 Ashes then.
I thought you'd never ask.
Well, a lot of people, again, tend to forget. You know, they remember, they've all got their favourite moments. But again, it comes back to our obsession with hundreds. Batsmen being defined by hundreds. You didn't score 100, but you scored 431 runs. And yeah, you played a very, very significant role in a number of those test matches. But it, I guess it's the team, isn't it? I mean, it was just such an amazing achievement as a team.
Yeah, it was. I think it was the perfect crescendo, wasn't it? You're playing against an Australian side who had been great for for many, many careers and many, many sort of series that they played in. One in England, nearly every time they'd come over for about the last 10 times. And it just felt like it was ready. We were, as a group, as a team, had built for 18 months for that sort of series to be going out and been competing against them, to be able to stand up and play their style of play. We had a batting lineup who were prepared to be confident and risky a little bit and score at an aggressive pace. That was what the captain and coach wanted us to do. But we also had the bowling attack that could match it up also with, you know, two lads who were bowling at sort of 90 plus miles an hour. One was Steve Harmison, who was world number one bowler at the time.
Oh, Stephen Harmison with a slower ball. One of the great balls.
Andrew Flintoff, whose bowling was superb, especially in that series. He'd put in some monumental efforts.
Here's a big shout. He's gone. It's the wicket. Andrew Flintoff is turning this game around. He did it with a bat first. First up today, now with the ball.
Backed up with Simon Jones and Matthew Hoggard in that sort of aspect. So it was a group together that worked and that was making great inroads into, you know, to playing against many good sides.
Do you watch it back? Have you got the box set?
We did. We all got sent them afterwards. But it's very often they will put on the Ashes 05 and reminisce and sit back and enjoy it, because everybody loves to see us beating Australia. Of course they do. But it's very often still on the TV, and they have anniversaries every 5 minutes about, you know, it's been at least 12 weeks since we put on the Ashes 05. Let's put it on again. So you get to sit back and enjoy those sort of occasions quite often.
What's the favourite innings you played during the 05?
Yeah, the 90 I got at Edgbaston.
That's the slider, and well driven by Trescothick. And that couple brings up a very nice half century for the Somerset man.
You know, you pretty much enjoy that. There's some shots within that, and the timing and the aggression of going into that game just seemed to work. Very disappointed, obviously, not to get 100. And it is, I don't know if you, obviously, you'll know, but quite often there's times when you're batting when the bowler rushes you a little bit, you know, and you look up and he's a little bit closer than you're expecting. And that was very much the case when I got out on that ball. I probably, you know, it's one of those you probably should have just pulled away and said, sorry, I'm not ready. But, the rest is history after that.
You mentioned the aggression. I mean, it took viewers collectively, took their breath away. It was staggering. It wasn't something that many English fans had were used to seeing from an English test batsman, certainly not an opener. Do you think, first of all, did you walk out there feeling bullishly aggressive? And do you think it took the Aussies' breath away?
Well, I think we walked out there with obviously a slight spring in our step, knowing that Glenn McGrath wasn't going to be bowling at us, having already stood on the ball and been carted off to hospital. But I think we all knew at that time, we knew the Edgbaston pitch pretty well, that it was always pretty good, and started flatter and got worse with a bit more up and down and a bit more spin as the game went upon. So it was always the best time to bat. You knew day one was always the best time to go out there and enjoy and hit it. And I think it just made its way. It just built upon momentum, didn't it? We got off to a nice start in the first few overs, a couple of nice boundaries.
There's a man back, but he can only watch one bounce four from Marcus Trescothick.
And then we started building, and then not losing a wicket for a good period of time. You can then be a little bit more aggressive and a bit more expansive against, you know, spinners or other seamers when they come on to, you know, come into bat. And things were happening. You were hitting the ball and they were missing it, or I think I got caught off a no ball off Kasparovic again. I thought another wafty drive and got caught at gully off a no ball. And it was just, everything was falling into place to just go in and carry on. And momentum's an amazing thing, isn't it? Once it builds in your favour, it's a very enjoyable time to be playing the game, because everything seems to go the way you want it to go.
What do you say to those lovers of statistics? And there are many, many of them in cricket, who say that that if you played the full England career and it had come to an organic end, that you would have comfortably passed Graham Gooch's test record, and that Sir Alastair Cook, would have been chasing your record.
It's always nice to sit back and potentially that might have happened. you know, for me growing up, obviously watching Graham Gooch, Gower, these type of people batting was obviously pretty special. Then Mike Atherton and Alex Stewart and these sort of people. But Gooch obviously had set the benchmark for everyone here. So that would have been a nice feeling to be able to try and chase him down, of course. But I don't look back upon it with regret to think that I never had that option or never got to that point. Well, I had a great time and I had 6 years of brilliant time playing international cricket and loved, you know, a lot of those times. I don't have a great deal of regrets about it and thinking, Reiki, I would have loved to have played. Of course, I would have loved to have played for 10 years or, you know, 12 years or whatever it would have been. But it was what it was. You know, there was too big a price for me to not walk away. But it was, you know, that's it. I'm comfortable with the fact that I never had that opportunity to, you know, to go on and do bigger things. Of course it was, but, you know, I don't sit on it now and think, oh yeah, really would have the opportunity to come around and to play it. It was just, that's just part of the professional career that you have nowadays.
Make that 100. Great way to bring up the 100.
So I mentioned in the introduction that you scored 122 hundreds. Again, that makes my eyes water. But you missed out on the double of 100 hundreds and 100 wickets because you only finished with 98 wickets, if my research is correct. So let's talk about
If you had sent me this information a long time ago, when I was captain, I would have definitely bowled myself more to get out those extra couple of wickets. I could probably think about it. There's a couple. I know I had Graham Hitt dropped at slip once with an absolute dolly, and I was like, how have you not caught that? But I should have got more wickets. And I definitely should have got more hundreds. Scoring hundreds was never a massive part of my, a massive strength of mine, I would definitely not say. You know, with someone, you see other people that you just know when they're going to get, like Alistair Cook, right? So Alistair Cook just seems to churn out hundreds left, right and centre.
What a way to bring up three figures. Alistair Cook has done it. A century in his first ever test match and now a century in his last.
Mark Rampakash, Graham Hick, they just churn out 100 after 100 after 100. That was never my strength, I don't say. I learned how to get better and kind of do it okay. But if you think, if I was one part that I would have said, I should have scored another 35 hundreds, I reckon, on that top, on top of that. In 27 years.
You scored 122 of them.
Yeah, but that's across two or three formats, isn't it? You know, yeah. 66 hundreds in first class cricket, I should have got more. You know, there was periods when I struggled with nervous 90s and stuff like that, and I had to work at that in the mental sort of process of doing it. I think because there was so much put on it, you know, the kudos of you getting 100, it was like the be all and end all, wasn't it? That's what you go out to do every time. I go out every game to get 100. Well, we know that's not possible, and you know, it's getting 50 is as good as 100 sometimes, but. I would have loved to have been better at it. I would have liked to have been more ruthless at doing that, as good as some people were.
Hey, I was talking about your bowling. 36 first-class wickets, 57 List A wickets, 4 in one-day internationals, and 1 test wicket. Who was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. Of course I do.
Well, that is the softest whistle. And as I say that Marcus Trescothick, the experiment has come to an end. Well, I'm not sure that would be greeted with too much enthusiasm in the Pakistani dressing room.
It was in Karachi. Obviously, we haven't played there for a long period of time. It was in a famous test match that ended up almost in the dark. And in the first innings of the first day, I bowled first change in a test match.
What?
And I got, yeah. So Darren Goff and Andy Caddick opened the bowling and I bowled first change. How Nasser Hussain managed to get that, made to do that, I do not know. But I had Imran Nazir caught an extra cover.
All part of the plan?
Absolutely, yeah. I just took a slight bit of pace off it so that he was through his shot and just lifted it straight to Ashley Giles at extra cover.
You always had a massive smile on your face that I remember when the captain did throw the ball to you. Did you love the bowling?
Well, yeah, to a certain extent. I thought it was always great fun being involved in the game, wasn't it? I think if you would have been just a bowler who's had to do all the donkey work and then not enjoy the batting or... You know, if you did nothing else but just bat, you know, I think, you know, it can get quite boring at times. I think you want to be involved in it. Like standing at slip, you're involved in the game all the time. If I'd have been down at fine leg, I reckon I would have drifted off quite easily and been away, not in the action. So getting the ball and, you know, turning your arm over or keeping wicket standing at slip, all these little things that you could do to be involved in the game. That was all, you know, exciting to me.
Yeah, keeping. Let's go there.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed that. Really enjoyed that. It was, I kept wicket from a young age in the junior stuff that I did. And I just, you know, it was great fun. I was never particularly the most mobile keeper. I was very much about just trying to catch the ball. I didn't really worry about how it looked. And I did, what, 4 or 5 games, I think, keeping wicket, one in India and I think 3 or 4 in New Zealand. Great fun. Loved keeping wicket. And even today, I've been coaching at Somerset. And obviously, we're in strange strange times with lockdown and stuff. But I've now got my gloves there that I can now catch the ball off the spinners and stuff and throw them back. So today, I was just catching a few and just sort of reminiscing and enjoying those moments when you had that chance.
Is coaching something that you are always heading towards? And is it? Are you hoping that it will be long term?
Very much so. You know, I guess in the last sort of 5 years, I sort of branched out during my sort of lack of playing white ball cricket, having stopped that sort of 3-4 years ago. During that time, I was allowed to then go off and do quite a bit of media work with Sky. And sort of commentary and various bits and pieces. And that's brilliant fun. And I still really enjoy that. But I see the direction finally when it, you know, obviously when it comes and sort of makes that choice that, you know, I want to be coaching and become a head coach. That's what I want to do. I'm lucky a bit at the moment. I can still sort of dip in and out of it because we get winter times off where you can have a bit of period of time and sort of still do a bit of punditry and stuff. But coaching, you know, the buzz of helping the next generation or somebody improve on their game, get them back on track or just sort of guide them in the right direction to be onto international cricket which is great. And that gives you a lot of pleasure because A, you're still involved in around the sort of the atmosphere of the team and what goes on. So it's a continuation of what you've always enjoyed doing and being involved with.
Time's up, Marcus Trescothick. I can only thank you once again for your career, actually, for all the entertainment that you've provided, and for the courage and leadership that you've shown through the second half of your career. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil.
You're listening to the Following On podcast. A big thanks to both Marcus Trescothick and, of course, Neil Manthorpe. Remember, you can always download the Following On podcast from Apple Podcasts, Acast, Spotify, and now the free TalkSport app. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.